building your first website. There's multiple ways of sort of building a website, and I just want to run through these. Some of this is going to be familiar to you guys just from sort of being engaged in the digital space or being a consumer of websites. The first one is HTML. Basically, what HTML is a markup language. It basically is a way of encoding plain text to tell it to do things. Most people combine that markup language with a cascading style sheet or a CSS file, which is all of the aesthetics that go with it. Those two things together create websites. So everybody that surfed the web in the early 1990s, that's pretty much what was running the web at that point, was HTML sites with CSS sheets. This is what a lot of universities run their websites, or they used to run their websites off of. HTML templates allow for easy content addition, so if you have an HTML template, it's super easy to do things like bold them using a what you see is what you get editor, WYSIWYG. So it allows you to bold things, italics things, bullet point things, super easy to add new content. Where this matters for project development is HTML does require web design knowledge to manipulate the design elements, especially when you're dealing with the insertion of visuals and visualizations. So if you're trying to insert a map, you have to understand how to center it in the column using this particular thing and know how many inches or how many pixels you have to go to make it appear here. So how many times have you guys got to a website and like the text is wrapped around the object weirdly? That's because they use the template setting instead of fixing the code so that it doesn't wrap around it in a weird way. And HTML standards change over time. So the new standard or the standard people run right now is HTML P5. A lot of the web is built on HTML 2, 3, and 4. You know those ugly websites when you see them. They're the ones usually with broken links and weird menus. They're also the ones that get hacked a lot because they, you know, aren't real smart about how they run their HTML and CSS sheets. We've talked already a little bit this week about content management systems. I showed you guys MythPress earlier this week. What content management systems are basically databases in the back end that work with an HTML front end. And what happens is the HTML asks the database to provide the content information. Okay? So basically what it allows you to sort of do is use PHP, which is like a scripting language, to do the sort of like make it look pretty work, like, you know, put in the menus and have the menus all show up standard or move blocks of text around. PHP is super useful because of the fact that it doesn't necessarily require for simple websites you to have any real scripting or, you know, coding knowledge. The guys who do our stuff obviously know PHP and use PHP all the time so they can fix things and customize them. But a simple website, you really don't need to know anything important. Where this is nice too is that oftentimes with content management systems, there are universal modules and organizational elements that already come prepackaged. So things like how to create menu and tree structures, how to insert video elements, how to insert photos, how to insert a header, how to insert a bar on the left, a bar on the right, all of those things are available in content management systems, and you don't have to figure out the code yourself. You just check the little box and say, I need something on the right or I need something on the left. And this is really key for a lot of people when you have content that becomes something you want to keep up to speed a lot or you want to change the way things act. Content management systems offer you the ability to change templates and visual elements without having to rebuild the entire site. That means if you decide you want to move your top menu navigation, so the header bar across the top that allows people to navigate your site, to the side of your website, to the left-hand side, to make more space or something, you don't have to rebuild all 350 individual pages that you built for that website. You just tell it to move everything and it does it itself. The thing you have to remember with HTML versus CSS is that HTML has each individual page is a file. Okay? That means anytime you want to make a change, you have to update that individual file. And anytime you change that file, it has repercussions for others that it relates to. So if you change the URL for something on one page, you may have to change the links on every single other page that it points to. Okay. This is why we don't advise HTML CSS unless you are somebody who's going to code it yourself. The nice thing about CMS systems is that it allows for different roles and authority and responsibilities for your project. So Simon and I, for example, for DHWI have administrator rights. That means I can change anything, he can change anything, we can create accounts, do whatever we want. You guys have author rights, which means you basically get to log in and see what's going on and comment.
But you can't change the way things look and operate. But you can't edit the content that's already there. Okay, that's the nice thing about these things. Modular add-ons like blogs and visualizations and analytics already can come pre-packaged. So we run Google Analytics on WordPress every month, or actually every day. It automatically updates itself and add another day, and I can at any point pull that all out and take a look at what's going on. Search engine optimization is built in. So doing things like, you know, keywords and correcting for things so that they show up higher in ranking results, you can literally push a button and it will do search engine optimization in a content management system. So correcting all the little things that are hanging out there that may make you go to item number 34 instead of item number 4. And also, content management systems are search engine friendly. And the main reason why they're search engine friendly is because unlike individual HTML pages where it may have to search every single 300 page, you know, all 300 pages that you have, in a content management system will wrap your entire site in sort of some metadata and it tells a search engine what's already in that site. So it's more efficient for the search engine to behave. In terms of principles for accessible design, so this is something that we firmly believe in here at Myth. And it's something we're still working on improving in terms of text size for our website. So our text is a little small on some pages, and it's an issue. It's about principles of accessible design. Make your website accessible not just for disabled users, but for people who surf the web all the time and have tired eyes or tired fingers. Hyperlinks should open in the same browser window. There is nothing more annoying than you click something and 854 windows cascade open. You should have access keys to navigate menus and submenus. And this is a big thing for Braille and people who use screen readers, so who are visually impaired. You need to have some sort of combination on your website that they can use to navigate without a mouse, okay? Or navigate in a touchpad environment. So what an access key does is it says, I need you to open the top level menu on the left-hand side. So Alt C plus 8 automatically takes you to this particular menu. Alt C plus F this does this menu. So think about when you hit Control P on your computer to print something. It's basically access keys are to navigate a website. Include audio shortcuts and transcripts. This is particularly key if you're going to be working in multimedia materials or in materials that are text heavy and somebody has a screen reader. So doing things like at the end of a paragraph, you can create it so that your website says, go to next paragraph, go to the end, and we'll give audio cues. These are things that are more complex and you get into in advanced digital humanities design, but this is a good thing to sort of be aware of, is that you have to think that there are users using your website who aren't going to be pointing and clicking with their own eyes all the time. And include alternative text for all images, and this is something that you get caught on all the time and we actually forget sometimes. Any image that you have should be tagged with the title of the image so that if the image does not load, somebody knows what's supposed to go there. Okay? This is also important because when a screen reader works, so when it actually takes the text that's running behind the website and takes all the visuals off of it and is telling somebody who's blind what's going on, when it gets to the image where the image is supposed to be, it'll actually read what's in those brackets and tell the person what that image is. So image of Martin Luther King, da-da-da-da-da. It will describe for them what the photo is. Okay?
Again, paying attention to who your potential audience is and serving the public. This is really important, too. CMS systems usually do this automatically. So this usually comes about when you're dealing with building your own individual HTML sites or when you're building mobile apps. Include a style sheet that supports resizing of text. So, how many of you guys have used a Kindle Fire or something like that where you get to make the text size bigger and bigger and bigger? You want to do the same exact thing on a website so that you can make the text bigger and bigger and bigger. So that, for example, when you're broadcasting on a room-sized screen, the text doesn't show up super, super tiny. Okay?
More fundamentally, if you have someone who has a visual, who struggles to read small text, they can expand the size of the text without it destroying your layout so they can still interact with it in the same way.
Yeah, so sort of standardizing the user experience. Use consistent elements correctly marked. This is the header issue. So your top level header should be H1. If you go down a paragraph and then indent something, that should be at H2. If you then go and add a bullet number of lists underneath that, that should be H3. You know, then what CSS does, or what the PHP does, is it says H1 shows up in Times New Roman 24, and H2 shows up in Arial 16, and down, down, down. In other words, create those hierarchies and those rankings because you associate them with text styles and with colors. If you use Flash content, and I cannot say this strongly enough to avoid Flash because it is actually no longer supported by most universities as something that they will help you fix if it's broken, include a text transcription. So if you're going to include some sort of whiz bang destination thing when somebody gets to your site that's going to make everything move and run and there's going to be audio and whatever, if that breaks, what goes in its place? Or if you're not somebody who can see and hear the whiz bang and understand what's going on, then a screen reader will tell them, please press start.
And also at a practical level, you know, there have been iPads and other Android devices. Flash is not supported by either anymore.
Right. So you cannot get Flash content on an iPad, an iPhone, or an Android. Yeah. You have to use a plugin, and most of those plugins are really bad.
What is replacing Flash?
HTML5.
HTML5 has a whole standard for embedding multimedia and hypermedia. And this is, again, where HTML has evolved in this edition very significantly, that it actually addresses all of that visual rhetoric that it didn't before.
So it's no longer sort of separate.
It's no longer two separate things.
Yeah, the HTML5 language allows you to do things like easily embed video and audio, but it also has sophisticated text transformations and animation elements to it. It's not something that you necessarily need to know beyond saying to a web designer, I want my site designed with HTML5, not Flash.
Right. Okay, so JavaScript alternatives or JavaScript non-enabled. JavaScript basically is sort of a way of which you can be, you know, like create behaviors on your website. So things like filling in forms, or pressing submit on a button, or checking things where the check goes back to the person who owns the website to tell them to do something. You want to be sure that you have a solution that if your site uses JavaScript and the person who's consuming it doesn't want to use JavaScript, that there's an alternative. Like the form is a link also that they can send to you as an email. Or that if you say things like, or you tag it as to open an email, because you know they have the ones where like mail to and you fill in the address that you want the mail to come to. That's a JavaScript behavior that opens up your native desktop email client. There's a lot of people who will not allow that to happen on their website because that's how viruses and things like that can be introduced. So making sure there is an alternative to that. So instead of using the mail to JavaScript behavior, you might literally want to have, please send email to your name at, the words at, not the symbol, at whatever the parts of your address is. Do not ever, and I cannot state this enough even though I do it, for your project, put out your email address in the correct form that it goes into an email account. So never do jenjuliano@gmail.com in text on your website. There are troll bots who will look for those things and pull them off, and all of a sudden you will be getting ads for, I don't know, mail order brides in China or something. You want to spell it out phonetically. And that's a standard protocol right now in all website communication. Yeah.
What about the dot? So like I've
D-O-T is usually what a lot of people use. You can just leave the dot. It kind of depends. I'm really bad and I don't really care about my Gmail being trolled because it's my public address and it's out there everywhere. But when it comes to my actual like university mail, I actually spell out the entire thing. First name at @atumd. dot, D-O-T, E-D-U.
And then I've seen some people put the at and the dot in square brackets.
Yeah, it just kind of depends on the person.
But that doesn't help the troll bots.
Nope. Okay. No. And also the other thing I want to say is include multiple formats of documents. And by this I mean not everybody uses Word, not everybody likes Word, not everybody likes a JPEG or a zip file or whatever. Include multiple formats.
So this is where a TXT file or an RTF file is very useful, because TXT text, a plain text file, and an RTF, a rich text file, can be opened regardless of what the operating system is. So it can go to Mac, it can go to Word, it can go to anything. Both of them will open those two types of files with no problems.
And regardless of what is installed, generally speaking.
And regardless of what is installed. So every Mac that you see around the room has something called Text Wrangler, or actually
text editor,
installed natively. That's basically something that reads just text and RTF files. So you never actually have to worry about having Word installed on your computer, and you could live without it if you had to. Couple of other quick things. Migration and transferability. So for those of you who don't ever plan on staying in your job forever, which I hope is everyone in this room that you attend to, you know, have a new job or get promoted or leave your university or retire someday if you can afford to. Here are some issues about migration and transferability of websites. You want to make sure your website gets updated regularly. So new versions of software and plugins and the things that you use on your website come out often. We actually just got into this discussion yesterday because our current MythPress beta has two installs that have been waiting for like 8 weeks. And when my web person comes back on Monday, we're going to talk about it. I'm a little confused why that hasn't happened. You know, updating regularly when there are security patches and fixes. You want to document any changes you make. If you decide to redo the content of your website, do not throw out the copy of that content. You instead want to go in and mark what you changed in the sort of comments marking that you can do in like a WordPress or a Drupal. So when you go to Wikipedia or those things at the bottom, it says, tell us why you're editing this. You can do that exact same thing in WordPress and Drupal. And you can actually do that in HTML using a set of brackets and a comment code to tell us what you're changing. That means somebody else can go back behind you and understand what disappeared and what's new. It's just good. It's good politics, good practice. Keep a copy of any major version of your site as you've seen. Internet Archive, Wayback Machine is a great place. They will troll your website for free and archive copies. They do not always, though, pull the embedded media and images. So you should keep a copy on your hard drive or with your project files of every major iteration you do. So if you decide to change color schemes, you decide to change logo fonts, you reorganize the entire site, keep a copy.
Can you ask Internet Archive to come to your site?
There's a form you fill out.
Oh.
So every time we start a new project and there's a new URL, we just automatically do a little thing and send it to them and say, please troll devdh.org or please troll whatever. That's part of their mission, is to collect everything that exists on the internet. Never build on your own server unless you plan to keep the site forever. This is a different philosophy than a lot of people have, and this is my philosophy, not necessarily Myth's philosophy all the time. A lot of people think if you have it on your server, then you are obligated to be the one keeping it updating and paying for all the work and paying for the data storage and paying for all the things that come through. So I actually encourage people to actually put their stuff someplace else. You may have a copy that your university runs and keeps up, but you have a second version, a backup version that exists on a commercial server that you may not distribute the URL to, that if you leave your university, you don't have to argue with them about do you get to take your product with you.
So by your own server, you mean the university server.
The university server. This is also important if you host your own website on your own actual physical server, because some of us do have server boxes. Keeping a copy of that site off-site, you know, so that if something happens to your server, you could back it up. Yeah.
So we have our developmental site on our own personal server, but we host them on a different server. Is that good or bad?
That's fine.
Okay.
I mean, it's not a big deal. I mean, that's basically what we do here at Myth, is we have one server that runs with all our development stuff and one server that runs with all of our public stuff.
Right.
What I will say to you with this issue about server and hosting things, even if your university provides you with the web space to put your project up, do not use a university URL for your project. And this is where the university and I always get into arguments. A university, and I've been through this with Miami of Ohio and now Illinois, can change their URL. And oftentimes when that happens, you get screwed because you're the last priority in terms of the conversion and the transferability. So Miami University, when I first started, was miami.oh.edu. And then it went to muohio.edu. And now they're doing Miami .ohio or something. They've been through three iterations of their site. We were always the last people to know that they were going to do this, and we were always the last priority for them to update the URL so that the redirect happened appropriately. This happened at Illinois. They went from uiuc.edu to now illinois.edu, and we had an issue with one of our projects because they used a specific site, and it took forever for them to get to us. So everybody kept going to the site and going, I don't understand, why is your project not there? Well, the university shut down those URLs because they were converting them all, so nobody could get to our project when it was running. Yeah.
Well, a lot of us may run like small projects where really you're just talking about a web,
yep,
a basic web presence. So do people often just use like go onto the commercial like WordPress or Blogger,
yep,
and then just buy the domain right through there and then just run?
So I run my personal, or have run my personal site. My scholarly site is jenjuliano.wordpress.com, which is the free commercial WordPress. They give one free account to anybody because it's super easy. I don't have to host it. I don't have to worry about running a server in my apartment. I don't have to worry about when I leave, moving it, whatever. That's a great service. There are Drupal hosting groups that will do that for you. Most universities have a file system that you can get a public-facing website from. All of our undergrads get it. And all you have to do is request it through your Office of Technology, and they'll give you directions about how you can do an install. The only issue it becomes is they may not support things like Drupal 8. They may only support Drupal 7. So you just need to be aware of things like that, and they'll tell you specifically what they support. But a cheap way to do it is just, WordPress.com. I mean, that site you saw for Myth is a WordPress site. It's been all spiffied up, but it runs as a WordPress site.
And then just go through WordPress, but buy the domains.
Buy the domains separately so that WordPress URL points to your domain
right.
name. Yeah.